There will definitely be a next pandemic. It's when, and you know, you can't predict that. There's animal viruses that are looking quite close to coming over and potentially spreading in a human population. And when that happens, it may be bad news. You know, misinformation is more exciting than information. And I think there's this, temptation to think, okay, I want to believe this. And if everybody else around you is believing that, then you're more likely to believe it too. So it's a real problem. You know, there's been a whole lot of kind of conspiracy talk, some of which involving vaccines, that really hasn't helped. And I think that that's been one of the things that really, you know, it's almost like an epidemic of misinformation.
Hello and welcome to the Experts in Health podcast, brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast aims to highlight the latest research and trends in health as we welcome a variety of guests from a host of different disciplines. I'm Dr. Chris McLeod, an academic in the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences with an expertise in behavioural nutrition and public health. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Duncan Robertson, who is a senior lecturer in management sciences at the Loughborough Business School at Loughborough University. Duncan, welcome to Experts in Health. Thank you for coming on.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, we're going to have a really fascinating conversation today because Duncan was at the heart of a lot of the strategy and communications around COVID. And I can't wait to hear your insight for this particular topic. To help our listeners and viewers, though, just to start with, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? You know, how did you get to that point in your life?
Of course. So my background is I started in science at doing physics at Imperial College. I then went and worked in the City of London for KPMG as a chartered accountant. And then I decided I wanted to do something that I wanted to do. So I did a PhD at Oxford University, and then I'm here. So my sort of background is, and my PhD was looking at models of competition, but quite a lot of that was inspired by models of competition from biology and viruses fighting each other. So it was sort of applying that to business.
Can you put a little bit more detail on that for me? How does that look like in a business context? Because I can see it in biological position.
Absolutely. So if you think about how viruses adapt and they change and they kind of fight each other, quite similar to the way that companies fight each other. Of course, it's a little bit nicer in the company world, and nobody would say they're actually fighting. But you sort of think of viruses or indeed companies on what's called a fitness landscape. So you can sort of see them kind of going uphill and getting into the way of others. So it's a similar sort of model applied to business. And it's really kind of using these sort of the background of science, applying it to business.
I see. Yeah, that makes some sense. What I'm not sure yet is how you then got from that point, you know, you're in your lecturing capacity at Loughborough University, and then there's the independent SAGE group, the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies. Is that right? I hope that's the acronym. How did you get that opportunity? When did that come up?
Well, I think it was a little bit of frustration at the beginning of COVID. So, you know, in January 2020, you could kind of see what was happening. That's 4 years ago now, so that's a very long time. So you could sort, you know, by looking widely, you know, even on things like social media, you could see things were happening in Wuhan, things that weren't normal. And then you could sort of see that approaching. So there's a certain amount of kind of seeing that coming. So writing letters to the press and that sort of thing. But then it was really thinking about what can I do to help essentially with this kind of huge societal problem. I mean, there's been nothing like it for a very, very long time. So it was kind of using that modelling that I do in management. Some of that modelling comes out of epidemiological modelling. And it was really thinking, OK, how can I use my expertise? Perhaps not to build the models themselves, because, you know, there are epidemiologists who are far, far better at doing that than me. But it was about the interpretation of those models and the communication of those models.
I see. So we'll get into that in a little bit more detail in a bit. But just to start us off, so this science communication during the pandemic, we're 4 years on, as you say. Thankfully, at current recording time, this isn't something that's a significant concern to the majority of our population. Why are we still talking about it? Why are you and I having this chat now? Why is it important for our listeners as well?
Well, I think it's hugely important. You know, we've got a public inquiry trying to work out why it's important. I don't think it's going to go on for another couple of years. So we'll be able to answer that question 2027, maybe. But it's something that I think, you know, the response to COVID was different all around the world. Some things went well, some things went really, really badly. And it's really thinking about what can we do and what can we learn? Because, of course, the COVID inquiry is going along. It'll produce a report. It'll have a whole lot of lessons learned and how many of those lessons will actually be applied. And it's really thinking about, you know, preparedness for the next pandemic, I think.
And because there is likely to be a next pandemic, is that fair?
There will definitely be a next pandemic. It's when. And, you know, you can't predict that. There's, animal viruses that are looking quite close to coming over and potentially spreading in the human population. And when that happens, it may be bad news.
Well, let's hope that the work you're doing at the moment will help us make that less bad news for us on a global scale. So take me through that experience that you had at the start of COVID. You know, you get the call that is thinking, you know, how are we going to work with this very complex issue? What happened?
So I suppose the first thing was looking at, it was actually from the Royal Society. They had a group of people who were trying to look at assisting them to model the pandemic. And my sort of training, I suppose you can call me an operational researcher. So I got together a whole group of operational research academics and practitioners and kind of helped the Royal Society group use those in whatever way they wanted to. And then after that, it was really looking at the data that was coming out. And some of that early data was pretty sporadic, and some of the kind of science communication was pretty, not ideal. And so it was thinking, okay, there's this data coming out. It's perhaps not translated very well. How can I help explain that? So if you think of, you know, the kind of government advisory group, which is part of SAGE, I was part of Independent SAGE. So SAGE, the audience for that modelling is not really the public. The audience for that modelling is government. And then government try and communicate that to the public. So remember those press conferences every day. And some of that communication, I think, wasn't ideal. So it was really kind of taking that data, those models, and really trying to explain those.
So what's the relationship that you had between yourself in the Independent SAGE and the government SAGE? Can you just spell out what those differences
are? So Independent SAGE was formed by a former government chief scientific advisor who, I think, had a view that some of this communication could be done better. So they were, I suppose, you know, independent of each other. However, there were a group before I joined, particularly of the behavioural scientists who were SPI-B. Some of those joined Independent SAGE. So they were independent of each other, and that's, I suppose, the name.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what was the data like that you were seeing at the start? What was it that was really quite noticeable that you thought needed to be communicated better?
Well, I think that, you know, the one thing I suppose is exponential growth. Okay, so you know, it doubles every, you know, week, for example, 4 days, whatever, and that doesn't look very menacing if you're sort of counting in the sort of tens or hundreds, thousands even of cases. And I think it's that sort of explanation of kind of what happens next. Nobody knows what's going to happen next, but really kind of trying to communicate that this is a real problem that you can do something about. And of course, the modellers in SPI-M were doing that as well.
Mm-hmm. And there were particular sections of our communities in the UK, we know at least, that were affected more than others. But there tended to be quite a blanket sort of strategy for how they would communicate this. Was that appropriate?
Well, I mean, what the strategy was overall, I think, was defined on a kind of week by week, day by day basis. I think some of that was particularly a political strategy as well. So, you know, what was the objective? I think that was my kind of question, overarching question. What is the government trying to do? That was never really defined. And I think that's something that, you know, could be improved, you know, going forward.
What would it look like if the government did define a strategy? Let's just go back to COVID. As COVID was, as we know it was in the end, if they were going to have a strategy, what would that sort of thing look like?
Well, it's not easy to explain, and that's probably why it's not done. But you could have, for example, trying to minimise deaths. That could be a strategy, but of course you have potentially a huge effect on, say, the economy. It could be trying to get hospitalizations to a limit, and I think that's kind of what they did come round to in the end. But of course, all of these things you're trying to kind of project or predict into the future, and that's really quite difficult to do because with the best will in the world, modelers can take into account what's happening now and what is going to happen, project that into the future. But if suddenly, I don't know, the Prime Minister says makes some statement which says it's not as important as perhaps it was before he made that statement, then that of course affects the results. So it's a really complex problem, and that's why I think the behavioural people were important as well. But there wasn't really a kind of communication, I think, between the epidemiological model, the behavioural inputs into a potential model, and the economic model.
And we know ultimately, the perception at least, was that the government made some mistakes in some of their decisions that were made. Is there anything that comes to mind further to the sort of lack of overarching strategy that you can highlight from your expertise that went badly?
Well, I think it was kind of trying to downplay this epidemic. And I think, there are a whole lot of things that could be improved. Too long to list, I think.
Fair enough. Yeah, well, we won't go into them with full detail then. From your side, just internally as an academic then, what have you learnt through that period of time about science communication?
Well, I think it's the importance of having people who know what they're doing. So there's this tendency in academia to focus, right? So it's all about doing narrowing your expertise, if you like, until you're into one very, very tiny thing, which is great unless something comes along like COVID. And of course, when COVID comes along, there are no experts in COVID, right? Because it just hasn't happened before. There are experts in, you know, infectious diseases, modelling, etc. But it's getting a group of people together who have a wide range of expertise, getting them to communicate with each other to try and understand each other. So virologists, epidemiologists, public health, primary care doctors, secondary care doctors, kind of what is going on. Now, each of us have our own expertise, but what we're trying to do is to make something truly interdisciplinary. And academics will talk about, oh, it's all about interdisciplinarity. But actually, sometimes that can be for writing a grant application. What we were trying to do is actually get to understand what this problem was and help explain it. So it's that kind of communication between a group of experts, but also communication to the public. But it's not just communication to the public. It's getting the public to communicate with you. So it's not a sort of, we are telling you what the truth is. It's really trying to answer questions. And some questions that come from the audience are really quite tricky. So it does take us a while to sort of work them out. So it's that communication both ways.
So then you get lots of different expertise in the room. You get the right people, let's say, hypothetically. And they're very different approaches. Some work on a very micro level, in the petri dish. Some who work on the population level. Different perspectives, different levels of granularity to the problem. You can then think about the models that they all might create, either individually or together. How do you, as an individual or as a group, know that you're right when you are then exploring a problem?
Well, I think the best way to answer that is to say what the Royal Society motto is, which is take nobody's word for it. And so the idea is that, really, you are never obviously completely right. You're trying to get as close to the truth as you can. But I think it's being kind of accepting of other people's models and approaches and knowledge and data, and really trying to understand each other. So, for example, in the work I do at Loughborough, I teach a course on policy and strategy analytics, where we go right down to the individuals. We model individuals. We model up to the epidemiological models. But we go in between in systems dynamics and all sorts of other approaches. So it's really kind of not saying my way is right. It's really trying to understand there are a whole range of approaches, whole range of models, whole range of techniques and backgrounds. And it's really synthesizing those and getting people to get the best result.
And with that two-way communication between you then and the public, how well do you think you as a group communicated that uncertainty about your work?
Well, absolutely. I mean, uncertainty was a huge thing. And I think, you know, certainly in the sort of official Spire models at the beginning, they sort of had a line that was, you know, number of cases, for example. Then they started adding in uncertainty into that. And at the end, they ended up with lots of different modelling teams independently producing models and then saying, you know, kind of what the trajectories could be. So uncertainty is a huge thing. And as I say, you know, a model's only as good as, you know, the inputs into that model and the assumptions into that model. And as I say, if you know, prime ministers say something, then that can mess everything up. So there's always that uncertainty that's kind of external to those models as well.
Yeah. And then if things do either mess up or things aren't communicated effectively, then trust can be lost quite significantly. We did see that quite a bit, and that still lingers to the present day, would you say?
So trust is hugely important, and I think you know, that's where a group like Independence Age was useful, because I think some of the official modelers and Sage, their job really was to communicate to the government and to advise the government. They weren't really trying to advise the public, because all of these decisions are very much political decisions. You know, should you have, for want of a better word, a lockdown? No modeler wants to make that that call, but they can produce models to inform that call. But it's really about trying to get the best evidence out.
So at the end of the day, the decision that's made by government always comes through a political lens. Do you think that can ever be taken away? So if you've got, you know, Chris Whitty there sort of talking, as we had in the press conferences, and says this is what the data is saying, this is what you should do, is there any way that in the future you can take the political lens off this, out of the science?
Well, I suppose that would be a political decision in itself. So if you're sort of saying we want to get rid of these politicians and have technocrats making those decisions, then yeah, you could do that, but it may not last very long.
Fair enough. So now we have the COVID inquiry. Mm-hmm. Can you just take me through what that is? When did it start? How long is it going on for?
Yeah, so it's a public inquiry and it has terms of reference which were set by Boris Johnson, really kind of almost defining an end date of the pandemic, even though the pandemic is continuing, saying they're going to look up to this date and look at all sorts of things about how decisions were made in government. You know, what could potentially be learnt. So it's a huge thing, you know, hundreds of witnesses, you know, thousands of pages of documents, witness statements, and really it's a judge-led inquiry to get to the truth, and it has powers to call witnesses. So it's a huge piece of work.
And then for many people to learn from what we did in COVID, what have we learnt so far?
Well, we haven't officially learned anything. I mean, it's been going on for a fair time, but the first interim report, I think, is meant to come out in the summer. Whether that's before or after an election, I don't know. But I think it's, I mean, what we're learning, I suppose, is how decisions have been made within government. And it's really, you know, what's kind of fascinating is it's very rare to kind of go into an institution and understand what was the method for making those decisions. And of course, you're dealing with limited evidence. So some people unfortunately lose their WhatsApp messages, for example. So it's a kind of a distorted image. But I think all the evidence, you know, in general should be there.
And we can only hope that we really do learn from this. Listen and learn.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, as I say, what kind of frustrates me is you have these lessons learned document and say, oh, yes, we've learned that lesson. But it's that putting that into practice, actually saying, you know, we've actually changed something. And I think, you know, we've had a few changes, but they've kind of been politically driven. So we had Public Health England going to UKHSA. OK, that was a change. But in terms of preparedness for the next pandemic, we're kind of almost going the other way in terms of getting rid of our vaccine manufacturing, our surveillance, our ONS COVID survey. And so it's almost kind of unpicking and testing capability. That's another one that's perhaps being ramped down. So we're very, very rapidly going back to business as usual. And whether we actually have the ability, if there were, you know, a new pandemic tomorrow, to go back to that level quickly to mitigate some of those, you know, issues, I don't think we're really there. And I'm sure there will be said, you know, in the future, in the report, you need to do this, but it will be another government's problem.
So why are we going backwards then, because that, on the surface, that makes no sense. You and many others have said there will be another pandemic. We've just had one. We've learned, we should learn a lot from it, but we're scaling back from an sort of an organisational perspective. It just seems to be, it doesn't make sense.
No, absolutely. And I think there's, you know, there's these sort of resilience and cost effectiveness waves that almost go through, you know, through society, through firms, through governments. You know, for example, in 2000, where there was floods and that sort of thing, they had a resilience program, which was, you know, great. But then it slowly kind of austerityed away. And then, you know, something happens and then suddenly we produce all this this extra capability. But that wasn't really something, it was a kind of temporary capability. For example, you know, you had outsourcing some of these testing, for example. And I think part of the reason for that is public health in this country, I think, has been, budgets have been cut, and therefore you don't have the capabilities within local authorities that you perhaps did in the past. And of course, you know, it's always that political decision about how much do you want to spend on preparedness. Mm. And especially if you aren't going to see those results until the next government, there's very little incentive in doing that.
And I wonder if because it is this government, albeit in a different shape, but that was at the heart of those decisions, I wonder if there's a sort of a fear to bring this up again at the moment, because, you know, we made some errors and actually we're going to move forward and we're all about a different thing right now. I just wondered if anything like that is involved.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, politicians aren't very good in saying, you know, I made a mistake, right? Some of them do, but most of them say, okay, there were limitations to what I could have done. We had limited data, delimited something. I wasn't the prime minister at that time. Those sort of, you know, so it's always about looking forward. And I think there is another thing that I think everybody would like to forget about COVID as well. Mm. You know, it's not something that people look back fondly to. So it's almost kind of dragging up all that kind of negative feeling. So politicians always want to look into the future, into, you know, the sunny uplands that are just over the hill.
Yeah, hopefully, fingers crossed. One thing I just want to ask you about is the disinformation that occurred over COVID and that we see is prevalent in many things. And, you know, at the moment, it's currently being a year where we're going to have a lot of elections, more social media platforms being so pervasive. That's a real big problem.
Oh, it's absolutely huge. And I think it was really shown up, you know, during the pandemic. So, I mean, there's, you know, almost the kind of scientific method kind of broke down in terms of getting some of these results out. In terms of, you know, normally you publish a paper, it's peer reviewed, it's eventually goes and gets published. But there was almost kind of this need to get science done very quickly. So things like preprints went up, which weren't peer reviewed. Now, the vast majority of those were excellent. And that's partly why there was that filtering process with RAMP to say, you know, actually, what data can we rely on? Even though, so it's kind of that rapid peer reviewing. But still, there were some preprints that went up in the early stage of the pandemic, which I have my doubts about the motivations for them. Mm. And so it's very difficult for somebody to say, OK, this, you know, professor of whatever at the university of, you know, prestigious name has published this paper, therefore it must be right. And I think that process broke down a bit. So absolutely, with that kind of that scientific community, that was an issue. But more generally, you know, there's been a whole lot of kind of conspiracy talk, some of which involving vaccines, that really hasn't helped. And I think that's been one of the things that really, you know, it's almost like an epidemic of misinformation. Mm. And it's, you know, misinformation is more exciting than information. And I think there's this, you know, temptation to think, okay, I want to believe this. And if everybody else around you is believing that, then you're more likely to believe it too. So it's a real problem.
If we take the idea that wish to jump on that bandwagon of misinformation is maybe something that's quite an internal driver that we just have as humans, and then we have these platforms where you can do anything, you know, obviously there are limits, but on these platforms you can communicate. Where's the fault lying with the fact that the transmission of disinformation is occurring? When you put these two things together, it just seems to be, well, that's obviously going to happen, but it's very problematic for trying to get the right messages out.
Well, it goes back to your question about how do you know what's true, right? And how is a social media platform arbitrating between what could be true and what could also be true without this kind of independent verification? So things like, you know, fact-checking organizations were useful in the pandemic and actually saying, you know, this thing that's being claimed, it's not true, and here's the evidence to say that. But it's very difficult to disprove something. Scientists don't, you know, it's very difficult to get that information across.
And when you take into account, as we had, you know, mostly during COVID, it was just people who were, ultimately spreading in the misinformation, even if it was facilitated via algorithms or companies or whatever. But we need to bring into play now artificial intelligence. And you get a whole new ball game of complexity.
Well, I think one of the things about the pandemic was we were kind of cut off from those interpersonal connections, right? We're all kind of in our houses or flats or whatever, and then the only information we had was talking to our nearest and dearest. But also we had to sort of go through social media, where this sort of information does propagate. But in terms of AI, yeah, absolutely. It's a huge challenge. And if people are trying to get views or clicks, there's a motivation to get the most exciting information out there, which may not be the truth. But fortunately, in Loughborough, we have researchers on AI. You know, the Vice Chancellor is one of the world's experts on that. So hopefully kind of setting down the boundaries and the limitations to what should be done, not necessarily what can be done, is definitely a worthwhile way forward.
And going forward, Independent Sage is still a group that's working in and around these areas, is that right?
Yeah, so we've stopped our podcasts or our broadcasts, but we have a Substack that is basically still going, and we communicate and really try and interpret things as they come up.
So what are you now exploring in this area, whether that's as an academic or outside of that?
Yeah, so what I'm doing at the moment, what we're doing as Independent Sage, we're looking at kind of trying to almost have a protocol for these ways of communicating science with and to the public. We're looking at kind of what can we do in terms of what methods can we do in order to help with the next pandemic as well. So there's a lot going on.
Have you got any ideas at the moment about how you do deal with the misinformation that's out there? How do you cut through the right messages?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's about kind of getting to that truth that's we're looking at. So if you are presented with information, you can do your own research. Everybody can do their own research, and that was a phrase that came up quite a lot. But almost you need to mitigate those effects and almost vaccinate against misinformation. And I suppose that's where universities come into play in terms of getting people to think about how to get evidence, how to understand evidence, how to interpret evidence, how to question evidence, and how to hopefully get to closer to the truth than you were before. So I think that's where universities have a huge societal benefit in getting people to understand.
Yeah, completely. That way of thinking. It's not just about learning content. It's thinking about analysing the data that you get from the particular source, and not necessarily thinking about making your own judgment on it, but being able to go through a rigorous process of inquiry, which we might call the scientific method as well, to say, well, within these parameters, this is what we know, and getting people to value that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a huge thing. And of course, even the sort of precursors to that, libraries and that sort of thing, that sort of, once again, we talk about austerity again, those sort of resources for people are perhaps more limited now than they have been. And I suppose this is where people have to then rely on internet information, which is great. But of course, there are other information that's out there as well. And it's that differentiation, how to know what's right, is a huge problem.
And then we can sit here talking as academics at a university to say, well, this is the scientific inquiry method and this is how you go about it. It took us a while to get to these points, actually. It's to then times that by 60 odd million people just in the UK to get to that point, it's not that feasible, actually.
Well, I think this is one of the kind of lost opportunities, I think, of those daily press conferences, right? You had the politicians, perhaps they were flanked by scientists, giving them sort of perceived legitimacy. But there was almost kind of an opportunity to you know, once the kind of political broadcast had ended, to just that explanation, say, actually, what are we talking about? You know, what is a virus? What is exponential growth? These sort of things, I think, could be done before. Now, the vast majority of people may want to switch off, but even if you get one or two people, you know, a few children thinking, okay, oh, I know what that is. I can then apply, you know, my maths to that. And then just getting people to, you know, be a little bit more, I suppose, for want of a better word, educated, and getting an understanding of how to think.
And hopefully that might be a new epidemic that goes through the country one by one.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think getting children to think about these things and not kind of, you know, talking at your audience, it's talking with your audience, trying to get people to understand things, walking them through rather than saying this is right, because as soon as that happens, you get resistance.
So that's one thing we need to do better in the future. What else do you think needs to be explored in this area that, you know, you can actually look at?
Yeah, so I think it is that communication thing. I think that's been the really important thing coming out of this, that you know, you may have the best model in the world, but if you can't communicate it to the public, but also to politicians, you know, people have always said, you know, you need more training for politicians about, you know, science generally, or just understanding concepts. Just getting people to understand these concepts within government, within policy, I think is important. And I think, you know, you see with some of the evidence in the COVID inquiry that, that you know, civil servants generally, this is a gross generalisation, but they perhaps may have done history degrees, and then they're interpreting all this scientific information. Now, civil servants are very talented and have a wide range of expertise on tap. But I think one of the recommendations by Sir Patrick Vallance, who left when he was running the Government Office for Science, was to get more maths engineering graduates into the civil service, particularly into the fast stream civil service. So that was his aim and his objective, to get actually a majority. But we've seen that percentage decrease, and we've actually seen the percentage of people going into the fast stream of the civil service decrease as well. So how are you going to get that expertise in is still an open question.
You know, just for your experience, you know, being in Independent Sage that took, you know, some flack over whether rightly or wrongly you were in the firing line, how did that feel? Because I can imagine that puts a lot of people off going into these areas when you actually get quite a bit of fire.
Absolutely. And I think the number of people who've kind of mentioned that in their evidence has been quite huge. And of course, social media, you know, it's great for broadcasting information, but it's great for people piling on as well. So absolutely. And it probably puts off, you know, some people more than others. And I think you don't need that. You don't want the people who are kind of always communicating to be a certain demographic. You want as wide a range of people to be part of that conversation as possible. And I think, unfortunately, there has been, I think, a disproportionate, you know, attacks on certain groups, which is very unfortunate. But that's the way misinformation and disinformation works.
And you're not put off by your involvement from what you've had, your experience?
No, it's been a fantastic to work with a range of people. I think that's what I particularly enjoy, working with a range of people who are just really interested in a subject, but from a wide range. And I think that's been great. Far outweighs the bad bits.
So seeing as you are on the optimistic end still, how would you sell what you do, you know, why it's important to the next generation, the people who might be in the next generation's Independent Sage?
Well, because I think you mentioned trust. I think it's, how do you get trust amongst a population where trust is probably one of the most valuable things holding a society together? I think, you know, what was, you know, pretty impressive actually is how society didn't break down. Okay, we might have run out of toilet rolls, but, you know, there was that cohesion that went on, and that's hugely important. How does that get maintained next time? It's going to be far more challenging because of that misinformation. So it's about getting that, once again, that communication, that explanation, getting people to understand what's happening, And to be kind of co-creating the response rather than imposing it. And as I say, part of the models I do, some are top down saying this is what we think about the system as a whole. Some of them are looking at, say, the individuals, the bottom up modeling. And I think you need to use both of those, but particularly you need to get the buy-in and the input of society, because, you know, the things that were done in COVID are pretty extreme.
And where can people go to find more information about you, follow what you're doing, or anything else about what we've talked about today?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on Twitter far more than I should
be. Quite a lot on Twitter. Yes, you're very active.
Yes. but more conventional means d.a.robertson at lboro.ac.uk, or look me up on the university website.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. Fascinating, and good luck with the next bit of work.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Great.
Not at all. And thank you very much for tuning in today. If you've liked what we've talked about today, then feel free to like or subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice. And you can also check out our other podcast, Experts in Sports, and you can find a link to that in the show notes. So once again, thank you very much for tuning in, and I look forward to welcoming you back to another health-related discussion in a future episode. Bye-bye for now.